Good evening, gentlemen of the Rock. I just feel like it's such an honor and a privilege to be with you, and I have to tell you that when my sponsor hears me say that, he'll say, please don't say that. We don't have honors and privileges in Alcoholics Anonymous. All we have around here are commitments and responsibilities, but it feels like a tremendous honor to be with you. If you're new, you're counting days, you have one of those yellow tags on, and it's your first time here. You have stumbled into something, I assure you, that is indeed miraculous. And someday you'll probably look back and think how it is that you got here and realize how little you had to do with it, that you got to land somewhere like this in your beginning days of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just welcome you. You're a part of something great. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing that I've ever been a part of in my entire life. And with that said, my name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. I was separated from alcohol on August the 30th of 04. I didn't quit drinking. I didn't put the plug in the jug. My best thinking didn't bring me to you. None of that crap I sometimes hear in meetings is true in my life. That would be arrogant for me to say that. It would be untrue. It would also, by definition, make me non-alcoholic. It would imply that I have power, choice, and control, that I could just put the plug in the jug and come to you folks. And, you know, I made this decision. And the longer I'm around here, the less it becomes just so clear to me how little I had to do with it. On August the 29th of that year, I was drunk as a monkey. And on August the 30th, I didn't have a drink all day. There's no chapter on that. There's no step on that. There's no sentence that says how that happened in our book. I now understand what it was a tremendous gift that my job with you folks and with this book and our wonderful program teaches me to do is to accept it, protect it, and respect it. And we do that by all of those things that were read. I had, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my first drink just so you know I'm one of you. And the fact that I could even remember that is a clue. If you are new and you could remember your first drink, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could tell you that if you guys invited me to tell you about my first glass of milk, I have no recollection. Which, you know, tell us about your first orange juice, I have no idea. You know, so right away you know that my relationship with this thing, alcohol, is fundamentally different than any other beverage by the fact that I can even remember it. The fact that it was a significant event in my life. And my parents' big crime, I grew up in Baltimore of a wonderful family. Nobody drinks in my whole family. No grandparents, no aunts, no uncles, no mother, no father. I have one little sister, 3 years younger. No one in my entire family drinks alcohol, so I don't know anything about any genetic theories of alcoholism. Our book says that we as a fellowship, I have no opinion on that. I know as individuals, we have all kinds of opinions about that. My sponsor's opinion is that I became alcoholic by drinking too much alcohol, and I've just gone with that. If you're new, don't try to figure that out. I mean, there's nothing more useless than how you figuring out how you became alcoholic. You can waste a whole lot of time with that. I sure did. It's like a guy whose house is on fire. I mean, it's burning to the ground, right? I mean, just everything you own is inside, and everything you care about and is precious and means anything is burning to the ground in front of you. And the fire truck's there. You all called the fire department. They're there. The hook and ladder truck, they've hooked up the hose. They've fed it through the yard. My neighbors, you guys, are all out in the front yard. You're feeding that hose. We got the line going. And I'm up front controlling the hose, and you're all screaming at me while my house is burning to the ground. Rich, shoot the hose. Please, would you shoot the hose? But I'm up front, and I'm going, well, wait a second. We got to figure out how this fire started first. Right? I mean, what could be less important than how the fire started? We've got everything you need right here in that book to put the fire out. But anyways, my parents' big crime, these wonderful, loving parents, was I went to a public school up until third grade. They took me out of that school in third grade and sent me to a private school to spend their hard-earned money, which they didn't have a lot of, to give me something that they never had, an education better than theirs, and an opportunity at life that was better than theirs. And I hated them for it. I thought they yanked me out of that school and put me on this school bus with these rich kids to go 45 minutes both ways to school. And they made fun of me. I grew up on a horse farm, and I had chores in the morning, and they called me farm boy and redneck. And third graders are good like that. They just tell you how it is. You know, they don't hold back. And I didn't know that I was a farm boy. I didn't know I was a redneck. I didn't know we were poor until they told me that. And that was the beginning of this thing that we experienced called conscious separation, right, from my peers. And I didn't know that was happening. And there were a couple rules at that school that I don't know if they have in Georgia. There's like a social hierarchy on the school bus where the older kids sit in the back and the younger kids up front. The school also assigned me a kid. His name was Reed, and Reed's job was to beat me up every day for something. I guess they do that here. And there was a girl on the school bus. Her name was Nikki, and Nikki was something else, boy. Good looking. I didn't know how to talk to Nikki. Asked Nikki out, sit next to Nikki. I mean, I had nothing. And I believe I was in about 6th, 7th grade. Couldn't swear on that. But all I know is that one day those kids, some of those older guys, they said, "You want to skip last class and do some drinking?" And I'd never skipped any class, and I'd never done any drinking, and out of my mouth came, "You bet," like I'd been doing it all along. And they said, "Well, what do you drink?" And I said, "Bourbon," and I don't know where that came from. And I wish it was true, you know, coming to a men's conference. This is how you know I wasn't shooting for AA and had no idea that I'd have to do this, you know, report back to you truthfully, because what I'm about to tell you next is just weenie. I did not have bourbon. What those guys had was peach schnapps. And so you're already laughing at me. But what makes me one of you, I now know, is not what alcohol does to me. It's what it does for me. That's why I get to be here with you. Alcohol does to the human body the same thing. You put enough in of it in a non-alcoholic, they'll get sick. It's called alcohol poison. Alcohol is a poison. Put enough in, it'll come out. You put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic and put them behind the wheel of a car enough time, they'll get a DUI or two or three. It doesn't necessarily make them alcoholic. That's what happens when you drive enough times after drinking. You put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic for a long enough period of time and stop abruptly, they'll shake, sweat, go through those early signs of DT. That doesn't necessarily. That's just what alcohol does to the human body. But boy, what I'm willing to let it do to me in exchange for what it does for me, that's why I get to hang out with you folks. Yeah. And on that day, those guys are passing that peach schnapps around. It doesn't matter what I drink, how often I drink it. None of that stuff makes me one of you. It's just what it does for me. And as that peach schnapps is going around that circle, the first thing I notice is that those guys are as lucky to be hanging out with me as I am with them. And I'd never felt like that my whole life. I headed out from that group of guys. I go into the restroom. I'm in that restroom, and I'm thinking about Nikki on that school bus. And somehow, in that bathroom, man, I'm in that little boy's room, going to the bathroom with that peach schnapps in me, and somehow I intuitively know how to handle this Nikki situation that used to baffle me. And I come out of that restroom, and I'm kind of feeling like a man. I get on that school bus, and I'm headed for the back of the bus where I know that Reed's going to get up to give me my beating, and I'm going to sit next to Nikki. And Reed starts to get up out of his seat, and as he gets to his feet, I get him with everything I got, and Reed goes down and out. And the whole school bus gets really, really quiet. And I sit down next to Nikki, and I'm looking at Nikki, and Nikki's looking at me, and I'm looking at Nikki. Man, and that silence on the bus, some of you guys remember that feeling of like long overdue respect. You know, finally, you know who I am. And when we got to Nikki's bus stop, she leaned over, and some of you guys will remember this. She gave me this little kiss, man, that was half on my lips and half on my cheek. It was different than my mother or my aunt had ever kissed me. I felt it in my toes, man. It was a big deal. And she got off, and we got to my bus stop, and I went into that nice house with those good parents with all kinds of morality and integrity and wonderful things taught in that house. And I was obviously drunk. And I got sick all night long, and they left me in the bathroom to teach me a lesson. And that was the first of many people that were going to try to teach me a lesson. And they left me in there to be sick all night and to sleep on the floor. And I woke up with that kinked neck. And in 7th grade, I remember I was grounded forever. And that's a big deal. That's like life without parole when you get older. And you don't know when it's going to end. And to this day, I don't ever remember feeling sicker. You know, and I woke up, and I'm sick as a dog. And I'm grounded forever. And my next thought was, are you ever going to do any more of that drinking? You guys know the You bet. You bet. I mean, are you kidding me? Sick as a dog and just grounded forever? What a small price to pay for what I had going on that school bus with Nikki and Reed and that feeling of respect. I mean, and what I didn't know was something with that alcohol kind of changed inwardly inside of me that I can't say any better than Bill. Where it set in flight much like a boomerang was going to give me so much for so long until it slowly turned in flight and would come back and one day shred me to ribbons. And I had no idea that alcohol was going to take from me or I was going to surrender, whichever way you like to look at it, every bit of morality, every bit of integrity that those wonderful parents gave me. And I was going to do it one drink at a time, and it was going to happen so slowly that I didn't even know I was doing it. And I drank as much as I could through high school. What drinking looks like in high school in Maryland is you get kegs of beer and go to cornfields after sporting events. It was back when the coach would sometimes take everybody's keys. He'd buy the keg. We're in fields. I mean, I'm not drinking all the time, but almost every weekend that we could get our hands on liquor, I'm drinking. I'm driving a CJ7 Jeep with no doors and no roof because that's what I could afford, and that's what I thought was cool at the time. And there's a night I got a keg of beer in the back and four or five of my buddies, and I come around a turn too sharp, and that CJ7 with the narrow wheelbase rolls, and it goes into the cornfield. And my friends are just sprayed across the cornfield, and everybody's busted up and bruised up and a couple broken bones, but nobody's seriously injured. And you know what I think about that? I mean, that's another one of those like near-miss situations that might capture the attention of an average or temperate drinker, maybe even a hard drinker. That might catch their attention, but not me. You know, an alcoholic of my variety, this stuff just goes right past me. They all end up, you know, I'd land on my, get up off the ground, and I think, man, did you guys see that right there? That was some good drunk driving. That was like NASCAR stuff. And I'm embarrassed to tell you that I've sat in many a bar room and had a conversation over and over that is so stupid it doesn't even bear repeating. But I say things, you're looking at a guy that says things like, I drive better drunk than sober. You know, I say things like, you know why I drive better drunk than sober? I got a good eye out for the police. So you put the windows 3/4 of the way down so you get a good breeze going. You get a cigarette going. You got to have the music just right. I do one eye. You keep the center line centered. You line that up with the right eye that's close. I mean, I have like a plan for drunk driving that I talk about in the bar. And there's other people in this room that has a system for drunk driving. You know, and if you have a system for drinking and driving, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know that regular people have that. And it's just embarrassing to admit, I mean, that I would have, and I believed it. I drive better drunk than sober. I start spending weekends in jail. My parents are leaving me through high school. They're leaving me in jail for the weekend to teach me a lesson. That goes right past a guy like me. You know what that is? It's a better story Monday morning. That's all that is. I end up getting to go to college. I go to college, my requirements for college. My father taught me to surf when I was knee-high. I don't even remember. And it's my favorite thing in the world. And so I end up getting a scholarship to go to the University of San Diego. It's 3,000 miles away, as far as I could go from those wonderful parents back east. And it's got good surf, and I'm going to be playing ball. And I'm far, far away from those rules and morality and integrity, and I love it. And I get out there, and I have two soccer practices a day, and I'm on that team with those guys. And there's about four other guys on the team that are on scholarship, and they're from right across the border in Tijuana, Mexico. And they have like 38 cousins each, and I've fallen in with them, you know, because water seeks its own level. We attract that which we are. My perception on this, an alcoholic also of my variety, we're pretty good sizer-uppers, if you know what I mean. I can look at a crowd of people, figure out what the deal is with this group of people and how to fit in. And that college, I mean, it is lined with palm trees down the middle. It looks like Beverly Hills 90210. The guys with the dough were getting the hot chicks, you know, and I'm sizing this up. I'm on scholarship, which I interpret as meaning I'm poor. Right? Because that's what happened. Poor people go to... I've since, you know, told that I could have looked at that other ways. Like, isn't it nice that they thought you were good enough at sports to go... I didn't see it that way. You know, I'm poor, so I fall in with the other poor guys on the team that are on scholarship. And now I got to get some dough to fit in, because another thing I knew, and no woman had ever told me this, but I knew that if a woman, any good-looking woman was going to go out with me, I was going to have to take her out first class. I was going to need a nice car. There was going to be flowers, a nice restaurant. I mean, it was just, I was going to have to do it up, man, because no woman was going to want me for me. And no woman ever told me that. It was just some kind of inward knowing that I had. And I sort of embarked on a course, you know, very similar to Bill when I read his story, you know, kind of in the pursuit of that to get some material stuff together. And I'd overlooked a dramatic thing when I picked this college. It was a Jesuit university. I didn't know what Jesuits were. I could care less. And so I got these Jesuit classes I got to go to. I got two-a-day soccer practices. I meet with a woman right when I get there. She's called an academic advisor. And, I mean, that sounds pretty neutral, doesn't it? You know, all her job is to help me pick classes that maybe, just maybe, I'll graduate in 4 years. But I don't see it that way. And when I've looked back through our inventory process, there's been a whole lot of people in my life like this woman. Her job was to just help me, to steer me in the right direction, to give me a friendly nudge along the path of life. But anyone that's ever done that in my life, I'm unable to see that they're trying to help me. Anyone that has ever tried to help me, I think you're trying to hurt me. You're trying to hold me down. You're trying to tell me how to live my life. Back off. Live yours, I'll live mine. And boy, through our inventory, there have been so many well-meaning people just trying to offer me a little friendly nudge in the right direction, and I don't perceive it that way. She says, you know what, you need to get some other things on your resume if you want to go do any of your dreams in life, to go anywhere. Being a mediocre student and playing soccer doesn't get you real far in the United States. You need to get some things on your resume that make it look like you're altruistic. At least that's what I heard, to make it look like you're altruistic, right? We all know about looking good on paper, right? I'll be what you want me to be. She said, we've had an idea here for some time about getting an Office of Alcohol and Drug Education started here at the university. We want it to be a peer counseling program where students with an alcohol or drug problem could talk to another student and get some counseling, where they're not talking to a faculty or administrator, student to student, peer to peer. We would like to get you certified, Rich, as an alcohol and drug counselor. You're going to be the founding father of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Education, and this is going to look really good on your resume. And I said, I'm your guy. And they do that. They get me certified as an alcohol and drug counselor. Now I've also got this business going with these my friends from the soccer team and their cousins in Mexico. I'm bringing this stuff across the border that I'm shrink-wrapping and sending back east to a whole lot of states. I heard the list read. I think I covered most of those states that are represented here. I'm doing a substantial amount of shrink-wrapping. Here's what my day looks like now. I have morning soccer practice, Jesuit classes, have to start doing a little bit of drinking, just a little before the afternoon practice. Then I have to do a lot of drinking and some shrink-wrapping because now the worst type of part of my day comes up. From 7 to 10 p.m., I have office hours where I have to counsel you pathetic people with your alcohol problems. And, you know, and I'm giving out AA schedules because you definitely need it. And, you know, and then I got to go back to my room and just drink a whole lot to be able to fall asleep. By the way, you're in the counseling session. If you need to just, you know, chill it out a little bit, come see me after office hours and we'll square you away. And our book talks about that often the alcoholic lives a double life. Often the alcoholic lives a double life. And I can tell you that if I'd only had two going on, that would have been great. But I had way more than that. At that point in my life, if any two people in my life that mattered would have talked, there'd have been trouble. If my mother and father, if they had talked to any of my teachers, there'd have been trouble. If my teachers had talked to my soccer coach, trouble. If my coach had talked to the registrar's office to see which classes I was actually enrolled in, trouble. You know, if my sister had talked to my parents, trouble, because I got different stories going to everybody. If my girlfriend had talked to my other girlfriend, big trouble. You know, and that, my friends, takes a lot of energy to keep everybody in your life separate. That's that thing called conscious separation. And I would have told you, if you would have asked me, I would have passed the lie detector test. I would have told you I have to drink this much to fall asleep. That's all I'm doing. I got a really busy life. Got a lot of things going. By my senior year in that college, I'd switched from the green stuff to the white stuff that I was importing. I'll tell you a little bit about what my life looked like now. Had purchased my first home, the third house on the right at Windon Sea Beach in La Jolla, 423 Nautilus Street, looking out at one of the best surfing beaches in the world and one of the most beautiful neighborhoods in this country. I don't surf anymore because I drink. I'm at one of the best surf spots, but I don't surf anymore. Hard to get up early in the morning when that wind's offshore and the dolphin are going past and the sun's coming up and the surf is just perfect because I've been up drinking on it. When I drink, all I do is drink. Everything must go. When I drink, all hobbies, all passions, everything that brings me any internal real joy has to go because I'm drinking. I'm dating the most beautiful girl in the school, or at least that's what you all thought, so I dated her. I still don't know if I liked her. I'm driving a silver BMW for any of the BMW people in here. It's got a number on the back that lets you know that they don't make or sell this model in the United States. It's a European one. I had to have shipped here on a boat because I'm that important. And I'm eating cereal with that girl at about 5 o'clock in the morning. And boom, 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 every single door and window in that house came in. And the next thing you know, I'm on my stomach. I have those plastic zip ties on that are worse than handcuffs. And chances are there's somebody here that's had them. They haul me off to MCC, the Metropolitan Correction Center, which is the federal penitentiary in downtown San Diego. I've been arrested a lot up to this point, but nothing like this. I want to get real clear with you guys. I'm a jail guy. In Maryland, jail is sentences up to 18 months. That's my specialty. I specialize in misdemeanors, 3-month sentences, 6-month sentences, 9 months, 30 days. I do life on the installment program. I don't care for big sentences. I'm not. There are prison guys. I'm not one of them. I'm a jail guy. And, you know, some people strive on that level of structure. I'm not one of them. And the federal system, I've never been in it, you know, and there's a couple people you'll get the feeling that I still don't really care for. They don't see things right, you know. They're prosecutors, you know, cops, and judges. I mean, they overreact to stuff, and they don't understand us. I mean, for instance, Bill and I are just squaring our way to bar tab out front of the bar, you know, seeing who's going to pay tonight. You know what they call that? Second-degree assault. They make it sound so serious. I mean, and everything's like that with these people. And so anyways, I go in front of this federal judge, and there's this thing called the Federal Sentencing Guidelines. And I have to tell you that the newspaper, the San Diego Union Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, my mother proudly still has a copy of both, says Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. So that's the headline in the papers. I'm in front of the federal judge, and there's this federal, the judges don't really have much freedom. What it does is a chart. And these guidelines, it's like the number of times you've been arrested, the weight of the stuff you had with you, and you come across in the chart, and in my case, it said 46 to 60 years. And I'm thinking, 46 to 60 years? I'm a jail guy. I'm not a prison guy. And I'm not given any bond. This was the first of a direct hit, though. A direct hit for me is the opposite, you know, of those near misses, the things that don't capture the attention of an alcoholic like me. That judge said something that caught my attention. He said, Mr. Bruckner's not going to be given any bond whatsoever. The U.S. attorney gave some crazy argument about how I would go to Tijuana and live happily with my business partners, who are looking to kill me, by the way. And but you know how judges are. They buy that stuff. You know, so I get no bond, and he said, how he said it, he said, if Mr. Bruckner is given any bond whatsoever, he will flee to Mexico, or he will live a happy and successful life with his business partners. That kind of got me. Happy and successful life in Mexico. I haven't been happy and successful on a horse farm. I haven't been happy and successful at my parents' beach house. I hadn't been happy and successful in Pacific Beach. I hadn't been happy and successful in La Jolla. And I'm not about to be happy and successful in Tijuana, Mexico with a bunch of people looking to kill me. What is this guy talking about? The next thing I noticed is that that penitentiary holds roughly 1,600 men. I was the only one in there that was guilty. I know that because that's all they talk about all day long, about, you know, why they're in there. It's like a lot of you that are here this weekend by accident. You know, you stumbled into AA. It's a big misunderstanding. You know, that's what's going on with these guys. And that's, they talk about it every day in the yard. I'm in there waiting for trial. And what I now know is that this power that I'm going to call God, because I have an hour to tell you guys about a lifetime that you have given me, and believe it or not, when I got here, if you'd asked me to talk for 5 minutes, I got nothing for you, and now it's hard for me to squeeze in what you've given me back to you in an hour. So I'm just going to use the word God. It's short. It's got 3 letters. I can remember when I was new, they made a mistake of calling on me in like an 11th step meeting. Never call on a newcomer. 11th. And it, you know, and I thought that was my chance to talk about what I thought about God or something. And I start going and I'm saying, well, I don't know about God. Here's what I can tell you. I'm a surfer. And I know that waves are energy that travel thousands of miles across the ocean, and a wave breaks when it hits half the depth of the size of the wave. So an 8-foot wave will break when it hits 4 feet of water. So a sandbar has to be in just the right place, or a coral reef for that to happen, and it's only good when the wind comes directly offshore, so you have to have the swell angle hitting the reef at just the right time on the right day with the wind coming in the right direction, and then if all that comes together, you get a good day of surfing, and I know that I couldn't make all that happen, so I'll concede that there must be something that could. And the guy sitting in the meeting grabbed me afterwards and said, "Hey, Rich, you just used up about 15 minutes of our meeting. We've got a word, God. It's got three letters. It's real short. And when you say that, we all know you mean that. We know that you mean the thing that makes the waves and the wind and all of that. And so just say that, and we'll know what you're talking about. So when I say that word, God, whatever pops in your head, that's what I'm talking about. I hope that the English language does not separate us, but it's the best we have to communicate. And our book talks about that too, that sometimes our words and their connotations could separate. I sure hope that doesn't happen tonight, because I'm talking about whatever it is that jumps in your head. And what I now know that God did for me in that federal penitentiary was God surrounded me with enough of me that I was able to see me for the first time. It was like one big mirror. And I would listen to these guys say that the reason I'm in here is because of my mechanic. And if my mechanic had fixed my taillight right, that cop would have never pulled me over. And if the cop wouldn't have pulled me over, he would never have smelled the alcohol on my breath. And had he not smelled the alcohol on my breath, he would have never pulled me out of the car, arrested me for DUI, searched the car incident to arrest, and found the dope in the trunk. So you could see that if I ever get out of here and find that mechanic, this is all his fault. And they absolutely believed that. And I'd told stories like that my whole life. Nothing was ever my fault. I bet there's a lot of you here. It's not your fault, right? And I had just, it just occurred, I'm like, man, I have been so full of it. And I was just able to see me for the first time. And the second thing that hit me in there, the beginning of this awakening thing, was that I was where I was because of who I was. And I was who I was because of how I live. And I'll repeat that because it's a big deal for me. I was where I was because of who I was. I was who I was because of how I live. In other words, I'm nothing but the sum total of my actions. Y'all are very big on that in AA. Another way of saying it is my tombstone is not going to say, "Here lies Rich Bruckner, he meant well." Because I always meant well. I never meant for any of the stuff that happened to happen, but it happened. Tell you something, I'm taking that Friday night shower, getting ready to go out in Los Angeles. You know the pregame shower when we're going out drinking and that cold beer's in that shower and the sweat's trickling down. And there's that overwhelming sense of optimism of what's going to happen tonight. And that cold beer's going down our throat in that hot shower and the steam. And I'm coming out and I put on that silk shirt and I spray on some of that girl sauce in case I run into one of them at the bar. You know, and then Phil says, "What are you doing tonight, Rich?" And I said, "Phil, you know what I'm doing tonight? Tonight's the night I'm going to go out and I'm going to shame my mother to where she can't look me in the eye for the next 10 and a half years. You got any plans tonight?" I never once did that. Got out of that shower and you said, "Hey, Rich, what are you up to tonight?" "Oh, tonight's the night that I'm going to embarrass my little sister to where she does not speak one single word to me for 6 and a half years. What are you up to tonight, Bill?" Never planned for any of that to happen, but that's what happened. I never intended for it to happen, but it's what happened. And that's what I brought to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, along with a whole lot of other mess. I'll tell you, I was impressed with you guys from the beginning, because in AA we share about some things that I found nothing short of amazing. Some of you new folks, I bet it's happened to you. In Maryland, there were people that would raise their hand and they would say, "Yeah, I drove here with my new car. I've got a valid Maryland driver's license with a Maryland registration with valid insurance, all in my name in the same state." And I would hit my sponsor and I'd go, "Holy cow, he's got the trifecta. Did you hear that?" And I mean, it blew me away, man. Like, I had no idea how you could have all three of those things in the same state at the same... I mean, I had them, but they were all from different states. And, you know, you used to be able to do the shim sham. Now they're all locked up. But I'm in that penitentiary for 9 months and 1 week. Turns out that a couple days before trial, the DEA had some problems of their own, apparently, with their honesty on an affidavit for the search warrant. It was determined to be an illegal search. The 27 kilos of cocaine was suppressed, so they didn't have much to do a trial. The case was dismissed. I'd love to tell you I walked out of the penitentiary a free man, but anybody in this room that's got alcoholism knows that I wasn't. If you've done any time at all in the penitentiary, you know when you get out, you are thirsty. And I could not stay where I was for a lot of reasons, and I couldn't go home because I was just too ashamed, and my ego wouldn't allow it. I'd shame those good people. My parents, anybody in my life that loved me, by this point in my life, I had bled them dry. The type of alcoholic I am, the more you love me, God bless you. I will suck you dry. I will take every penny from you. I will make you cash in your retirement to bail me out. I will turn every hair on your head gray. I will take every bit of love from you and just step all over it. I'm a user, a taker, man. I am just such a loser. It's unbelievable. And it doesn't even faze me. And the worst part is when I get to you and I go, only hurt myself. Only hurt myself. And I start bouncing around the West, and I go to a town called Jackson. Well, after Jackson, I end up living. The first place I live is Ketchum, Idaho. It's a little town by Sun Valley. And I stay there until I get in some more trouble. When I drink, I get in trouble. That's just the kind of drinker I am in a general way. I'll let you, nothing good ever comes out of my drinking. I've never come out of a blackout and, you know, had Tim come up to me and go, gosh, Rich, that was so nice last night. You were helping those little old ladies cross the street, and you were unloading their groceries for them at the garage. I mean, that was just amazing stuff you were doing last night. I get in trouble. Then there's warrants. When I hear about warrants, I run. I don't face the music because tough guys do that. I'm a coward. I run. As soon as I hear about a warrant, I leave. The solutions to my problems are usually worse than the original problem. I go from Ketchum to Steamboat, Colorado, from Steamboat to Boulder. I do warrants, warrants, warrants. I'm a midnight mover. You know, when I hear about the, it's time to go, I can tell you that if I had every single, I mean, I left furnished houses behind. And if I had every single television set back that I left behind when it was time to go, I'd have a Best Buy store out here. I mean, it's incredible what I left behind. You know, we run with that alcoholic luggage, the hefty bag, until we start again in the next town. And that was the story. And I end up eventually where all big shot, tough guy, you know, wannabe drug dealers wind up when the federal government seizes every single bank account, house, car, everything you own, and alcohol owns you lock, stock, and barrel. I end up back on my mother's couch in Ocean City, Maryland. And if you're laughing or nodding, which about half of this place is, you may be familiar with Mom's couch, which is a great place to start sobriety. And there's only one rule at Mom's house. I couldn't believe this lady took me back into her house one more time. I couldn't even believe it. And I was never, ever, ever going to drink again, and I meant business. And if you'd have hooked me up to a lie detector, I'd have passed it. I was never going to drink. Y'all know the rule at Mom's house, right? You can stay here as long as you want, as long as... Oh, yeah, we got Mom's couch, people. As long as you don't drink. There's only one rule. And that lasted 2.5 weeks. That was the best I could come up with. 2.5 weeks. And I eventually end up... I'm bopping in and out of your AA meetings. If I come into a meeting where they have that book up front, I try to go to a different one. I don't care for any meetings where they're talking about books or steps. In my area, they got these things called discussion meetings. I'm a big fan of them. You know, that's where somebody just picks a random, they say, you know, does anybody have a topic? And Franny raises her hand. They go, what's up, Franny? What's our topic? And Franny says, you know, my cat, Skittles. Skittles has been my cat for 16 years, and Skittles ran away, and I'm pretty sure they found Skittles, and Skittles got hit by a car, and we had so many good times together, Skittles and I, and I don't know what I'm going to do without Skittles. And then she calls on her friend Gertrude, who's knitting. And then Gertrude, it turns out Gertrude owned a Yorkshire Terrier, and she talks about this Yorkshire Terrier for 15, 20 minutes, calls on her friend. It goes around, an hour goes by. And I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying of the progressive fatal disease of alcoholism, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing no more about recovery from this fatal disease than the second I walked into the meeting. Maybe I'm a better pet owner. You know, my favorite type of meeting, and this is all because of me. I'm drawn to it. I mean, you know, well likes well, sick likes sick. You know, so I'm into these discussion meetings. And my favorite one, you know, does anybody have a topic? Bob. And, you know, Bob, my favorite topic. She left me again. She left me again. You know, and then Bob, you know, shares about this relationship 15 minutes. He calls on Paul, you know. Paul's on his fifth wife, but he's got some sage, you know, relationship advice for us. He goes on and on about relationships. You know, Paul calls on Mary. Mary's been married and divorced, married and divorced, married and divorced to the same guy 3 times. You know, but she knows all about relationships. She's going to help us out. She goes on and on. You know what happens? An hour goes by. Hour goes by, and I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous of the fatal disease of alcoholism. Knowing no more about recovery from this condition than the second I walked into the meeting, maybe I'm a better dater. And there's some people in AA, in all honesty, I got to tell you that I don't care for. A lot of you are here. They got that weird look and the smile. They're very clearly happy about being sober. I'm not happy when I'm not drinking. You know, happy and not drinking are not a part of my life. When I put together a couple days of not drinking, you know, I'm not drinking. That's what I'm doing. And, you know, what are you smiling about? You know, that is not fun. We are not drinking around here, pal. You know? And you all were like happy about it, and like it seemed like you were doing it on purpose. And it was, I was just sure you had something different than what I had. When I drink, my world does not get better. You know, it closes in. I become aware of the fact that the IRS is chasing me, that I got warrants in 3 states, that my own mother can't look me in the eye, that I have a little sister that I haven't talked to in 6.5 years. That stuff bothers me when I'm in this very awkward, vulnerable condition called sober. You know, and I need to fix that quickly. And there's this woman named Janine who I hate more than anybody, because Janine, Janine, she's 18 years sober when I meet her, and she's always got that book, that big book, you know, under her arm in every single meeting. She comes in, and I mean, haven't you read it yet? You're 18 years sober. And she doesn't call her sponsees. She doesn't call them sponsees. She doesn't call them pigeons. She calls them duckies. I mean, it's enough to make you vomit. And Janine comes into the meeting, and there's like 6 duckies in back of her, and she sits down, and dish, 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 dish. The duckies, you know, file in line, and they all and we get to the end of the meeting, and, you know, we give out these chips in Maryland. I don't know if you don't do it here for like 30 days, 60 days, 90, up to a year. Does anybody have 30 days? And I sit in the back, which is where, you know, it's like an unofficial AA rule. That's where you got to sit when you're new and pissed, and you got your arms crossed, and your hat down, and you're hating. And does anybody have 30 days, you know, and Marsha would come up and get her 30 days. You get like 10 seconds to say, hey, you got 30 days. And Marsha would go, Janine is my sponsor. I just wrote my 4th step. I have 30 days. I'm sharing my 5th step on Saturday. I think I'm getting free. And I'm in the back. And you know what I'm thinking is I'm going to knock her teeth right down her throat. I'm going to knock that smile right off her face. I mean, that's what's going through my head. You know, and does anybody have 60 days? And Stephanie comes down. Hi, Janine's my sponsor. I have 60 days. I'm getting ready to make my amends. We just did my 8-step list. I'm getting out there. And I'm in the back just thinking, I'm going to knock the smile right off her face, man. And then we get to the worst part of the meeting for me, and that's where they say, does anybody have 24 hours or a desire to start over? And I got to do the longest walk in Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. I eventually end up doing a residential burglary on my mother. At this point, she's got a restraining order. I'm not supposed to be 1,000 yards of her or her house. She's a little retired school teacher. She sleeps with a restraining order, with her door deadbolted, with her little purse underneath her bed. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. I need another drink, and my book tells me, just like Bill, when the morning terror and madness were on, I'll steal from my wife's slender purse to meet my mother, because that's who tough guys rob. I'm not robbing Tim. He looks like he might hurt me. Tough guys rob Mom. So it's 3 in the morning. I break into her house. I'm on my stomach. I'm doing my best commando crawl across my mom's bedroom floor. I got my arm under the bed, and I'm going for the purse. And my mom wakes up, and her eyes come right off the side of the bed, and she says, Rich, take it. Would you just take it? And that was another one of those direct hits, boy, because I'll tell you what, there's a couple of guys in this room that have been to the beach with me. I've been stabbed in Panama. I've been branded in Mexico. For those guys that I would never forget, they wanted me to always remember who I worked for and who owned me. And you can beat me up and you can lock me up, but don't you give up on me, Mom. And there's just something special about that. And she didn't give up on me, but it sure felt like it. What she had to do, I had pushed her past that point where we push those that love us, where she just had to be done with me because it became too painful for too long and she had to let me go to alcoholism. And I'd love to tell you I didn't take it, but you guys know I did, and I stayed drunk as long as I could on that, and one more warrant's out there, and I eventually come bopping back into AA after I get another 60-day sentence. I make it up to 36 days without a drink. I'd had my liver biopsied. I wasn't supposed to drink any alcohol whatsoever. Obviously, he said you have fatty spots. It's pre-cirrhotic. It'll recover. No Tylenol for a year. Apparently, Tylenol's bad for your liver. I don't know why. I'm not a doctor. Don't take that. Eat this. Don't eat this. And I make it to 36 days without a drink. And I get to this place that our book talks about where I can't go one more day without a drink. And I know I can't take so much as one more drink. And I can't do your steps because I don't have a sponsor and I decide things in my head for myself. I read your steps and I make it as far as 4. And I've heard you all talk about this inventory. You're real big on writing stuff down. I've already told you, I got warrants in 3 states. The IRS is looking for me, and the first rule of the business I'm in is you don't write anything down. It's called a paper trail. I just got out of the federal penitentiary. I'm not going back. And, you know, you guys are really excited about writing stuff down, and you guys say things like, it holds the key to the future. You know, no, sir, it holds the key to the penitentiary. And that's what I'm thinking. And there was only one problem with that. I couldn't live one more day with or without a drink. I took as many Tylenol and everything else in that medicine cabinet that I could to take myself out, because, again, that's what cowards do. They take the ultimate act of selfishness, and I was just going to take myself out. And what happens next, I don't have an explanation for, other than this wonderful power that you call God. What my neighbor reports is that at that point I lived in a crappy townhouse, because that's where alcoholics live. And when I fell down and my body gave out from taking all of those pills, apparently I fell into the refrigerator, which thudded against the wall. I've learned that lady next door, because of those thin walls, she was home from work sick for the first time in 9.5 years. She had a perfect attendance record at work, but that day she was home sick. And when that refrigerator hit the wall, it scared the daylights out of her. She ran around the front door, looked through the door, and saw feet on the ground. She called 911. I woke up in Atlantic General Hospital for the 4th time that I'd been in there that year. And when I woke up, I was in one of those sexy paper hospital gowns where your butt hangs out and it ties up the back, and things were beeping and tubes were going. And I had that feeling internally, you know, that some of you in this room statistically have had, you know, and that's that feeling when you know that you can't even kill yourself right. It's that place just beneath loser, right? You think you've hit the wall of loserdom, but when you can't kill yourself right, boy, there's a special spot for us. And that's where I was. And as my eyes cleared, you know, and I started to be able to see where I was and what was happening, y'all know who was at the end of that bed. Janine with the duckies. And I'm here to tell you, I don't know if there's a place called alcoholic hell or not, but I was pretty sure I was in it. And Janine did not talk to me that day, because Janine had tried to talk to me many, many, many times. But she did talk to the duckies. And she said, girls, I want you to take a good look. This is what happens to an alcoholic that refuses to take our steps. Let's go, girls. And that was it for me. Something inside me snapped. Maybe the last vestiges of pride or prejudice or knowing, or ego, or whatever term we like to put on it. But something inside me snapped. And I got to tell you, once I got into this book and read about Bill with the bright light and that cool breeze that came through the room, I was jealous, man, because he gets all that and I get Janine and the duckies. You got to be kidding me. But it turns out that it was every bit as significant, because what happened next I've never had happen before or since. The next thought that went through my head, I never had a thought like that. And all it was if I get out of here, if I live through this time, I'm going to find one of those old guys. You know, those old guys in AA. With that book in their hand and that smile on their face. And I'm going to do everything they tell me to do. That's it. That was my awakening. Pretty simple. And my life changed, and I went and I found the man that had shook my hand many times, and his name was Jim. And Jim had a sponsor. His name was Clarence Snyder, and he had a sponsor by the name of Dr. Bob Smith. And I only tell you that because it's important that we know what we get and we know where it came from, because I would hear some things in meetings, and I'd come back and I'd report to Jim, and I'd say, you know, this 4th step, aren't we supposed to, I live at the beach, aren't we supposed to go to the beach? I heard at the meeting, we light it on fire, we send it into the ocean, it's like a Viking funeral. So we got to go to the beach, right, to do this 5th step, and with the fire, and he goes, what in the world did you, would you please stop going to those BB meetings? And I said, what's BB, Jim? And he said, I don't know, but it isn't AA. You know, and he took the meeting list and he started circling the meetings I ought to go to and told me the ones to stay the heck away from. And, you know, some things started to change and I'm starting to like meetings I didn't used to like. And he's going through this book with me and explaining what Silkworth was talking about in here, that I'm a guy that this phenomenon of craving develops when I take any alcohol into my system. He called it an allergy, you know, that I'm powerless over alcohol. Less power. He said, would you agree with that? Powerless means you got less power? And I'm like, yes, sir. And he said, well, think about that for a second. Less power than is required to do what? What decision have you made time and time and time again in your life? That I'm never going to take another drink, Jim? Yeah, buddy. How well are you doing at managing that decision? Not very good, Jim. Okay, so you're telling me you have less power than is required to manage your own decision to never take another drink of alcohol. Why hadn't anybody in a meeting ever explained that first step like that to me? Boy, that made a lot of sense. And that's what you're looking at tonight. I'm a guy that's got less power than is required to manage my own best decision to never take another drink. And that means I'm going to need some power. And that's what the rest of this program is about, thank God. It's a getting power program. You know, you're not going to ever hear me talking. I mean, our book says nothing about this. You know, you're not going to catch me moping around AA talking about I'm powerless over people, places, and things. You know, my book tells me that I have uniquely been given the power. It isn't mine. I got to be real clear on that, right? It isn't mine, but it comes through me, through these steps, through this book, and through you, so that I am solely and uniquely qualified to help an alcoholic where no one else is. That's what the book talks to me about. Being given this, and you know, we got all kinds of poems, why we were chosen. Could have chosen the doctors, could have chose us to help another alcoholic where no one else can. And you know, he says, that's the reason we made this decision in step three. That's what he said, my third step. Would you like to make a decision to go through with the rest of the steps? That was my big third step decision. He didn't ask me much about God and my opinion and experience and all of that together after working with probably over 100 guys at this point. There is nothing more useless than a guy's concept of God at the third step. You know, I am not interested in that because whatever it is, it isn't working too good or you wouldn't be sitting at my table. You know, we'll talk about that later coming out the backside of this around step 11. And if your 11th step God even resembles your third step God, you may have skipped something in between. And that's been my experience with this process. And I made a decision to go through with the rest of this stuff. And I would say things, by the way. The old guys know there's code in AA, and I didn't know there was code in AA. They know this language, where I would say things like, he would say, well, what are you doing? What step are you on? And I'd say, I'm working on the third step. You know what working on the third, there's no way to work on the third step. It's a decision to either move forward or not. It takes like 10 seconds. But when you say, I'm working on the third step, you know what you're saying? I am scared to death to write a fourth step. That's what you're saying. The old guys know that. You know, so anybody working on the third step, welcome to AA, I was too. It just means you're scared. That's cool. We know that. And this is why we're here this weekend, because this is a place where a lot of guys will encourage you to move forward. You know, and that's that decision that I made. And I did that inventory and put it down. It turns out that the sum total of that inventory is I got a whole lot of busted relationships in my life. And there's only one guy that's got something to do with all of them. You're looking at him. Only one common denominator throughout every busted relationship in my life, and you're looking right at him. And we're getting down to some of those causes and conditions, and we do the same thing with, you know, the sex. Do the same thing with the fears. And Jim was getting older, and he turned me over to my current sponsor, Roger. And when I got to Roger, he said, kid, he said some words that'll change my life. We went through 6 and 7 and had that 8-step list, which turns out I already had from my 4th step. Glad we didn't burn it. Right? Book says that, right? 8-step list. We had it from when we took inventory, and I wanted to do a Viking funeral of my list. I'd have been in real trouble. And he said something that changed my life. He said, kid, you're at the 9th step. How free do you want to be? How free do you want to be? We got all kinds of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got everything in here from ground beef to filet mignon. What do you want? What do you want? Bill Wilson always talked about the good as the enemy of the best. You know, if you want to settle for some half measures, middle of the road stuff, right on. Not me. I'm a pig, man. I drank like a pig. I did everything I did like a pig, and I want everything AA's got from me. You know, I want it all. And he said that I'll change this because of the rules, Bill. He cussed at this point, but I'm not going to. He said, you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous is largely theoretical up till step 9. The whole program of AA is theoretical up to step 9. All you are, Rich, up until step 9 is a self-informed jerk. Nobody out there in the world cares that you've made some peace with the God of your understanding in steps 1 through 3. Nobody out there in the world cares that you've written a bunch of inventory and shared it with your God and your sponsor. They don't care. Nobody out there in the world cares at all that you could make a big, long list of your defects and shortcomings, maybe some assets. They don't care. Nobody out there cares that you got a big list of what you're going to make right. I've been going to make stuff right my whole life. But the 9th step, kiddie, he said, this is where you get to rub the record clean. Maybe, just maybe, you get to die with both sides of the slate even. And that resonated with me, man. He said, you're going to start dating your mother. Wherever that lady will go with you, once a week you take her to lunch, dinner, whatever she'll do. And I had my first AA job, man. I'm sweeping the floor in a picture frame shop. This longtime AA member carved hand-carved wooden picture frames. And I made $6.25 an hour to sweep the floor and keep the sawdust off the floor. And my hands were shaking. I was in rough shape, man, for the first couple months. And at the end of the week, I always had a dollar for your basket, and I had a little money to take my mom to dinner. And that was the first thing I noticed about AA, and some of you might have noticed that a little becomes a lot in AA. When we focused on the spiritual, the material always takes care of itself. I'd had it backwards all along. And here I am just worrying about this spiritual stuff that you guys are taking me along this path, and things are starting to change, and I'm dating my mom and dating my mom and dating my mom and dating my mom, and I don't know how many times and how long it took, but I know where we were. We were at Carrabba's, and I know my mom ordered spaghetti with meatballs that night, because I'll never forget it. She was twirling that spaghetti around, and she looked up from her plate of food and was looking at me eyeball to eyeball, mother to son, for the first time in about a decade. And that was a big, big deal for me. And that relationship continued to build, man. And when she started asking me to come over to her house to take out the trash because she's getting into her 70s, and can you change a light bulb in my kitchen? And she can't get up on a little ladder to change the light bulb. And just trusted me to come in her house again and those little things. And I would be there, and I'd be there that day. It used to take me 2 to 3 weeks if my mother would have asked me to come do something over there to sober up enough to show face at my own mother's house. That's how pathetic of a son I was. And because of you guys, I start getting to show up. The last thing, I will tell you this, I'm 3 years, this is my first marriage. I got married with not quite 9 years sober for the first time. I've been married for 3 years Absolutely, I'll show you some pictures if you want, because you wouldn't even believe me that this woman would marry me. I just finished the other night telling her, you know, that God loves me much more than her. And she said, why would you say something like that to me? And I said, well, think about it, honey. You know, God gave me you, and he only gave you me. And then she saw it my way. And we've got the most beautiful 9-month-old baby girl. Her name's Isabella, which means God's precious gift. It's an old Spanish name, and that's the literal translation, and that's what I feel she is. And we're able today, because I don't know anybody in this entire world 1 cent. I am even with the whole world financially, which is nothing short of a miracle. And because of that, we have a spectacular house right on the Atlantic Ocean where we watch the sun come up. I can walk from me to the back of where you guys are sitting, and I'm in the ocean surfing before I go to work each morning. And it's not the sun coming over the Atlantic Ocean. It's not that spectacular deck. None of that. You know, if you ask my mom what she thinks the best part of that house is, she'll say, my son chose to build a house 1.7 miles from my house so he could be near me when I get old. That's what she thinks is the best part of that house. The last thing I want to say for any tough guys, you know, that are like me, that want to be gangsters, that I was going to be a man. And it turns out that it's real hard to be a man without first learning how to become a son. And for some reason, when I got to AA, my next amend was my little sister, that girl that hadn't spoken a word to me in 6.5 years. I had a set of Baltimore Ravens season tickets when I came to AA. I had a black hefty bag of clothes and Baltimore Ravens season tickets. I have no idea why that is. But that's how we are when we get here. Our priorities are so screwed up. I guarantee there are people in this very room that are living in a homeless shelter. They don't have a house, a bank account, anybody in your family that'll talk to you, but you got an iPhone 6. And I have no, I mean, I don't have it. I just got, like why, you know? Like, how do you have that? You know, but they do. And that was me. And he said, send those tickets to your sister. You live 3 hours from Baltimore now. You live at the beach. She lives in Baltimore. And I said, these are expensive. That's stupid. And he said, I didn't ask you. I told you, send them to her. And I sent them, and nothing happened. He said, send the next set of tickets to her. And I said, that's really stupid. But I'm not asking you, I'm telling you, and I sent them. And you know what happened is my phone rang, and I answered the phone. On the other end was a little girl's voice that said, Richie, 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 did you see that? They just threw the ball, he caught it, they tied it up in the end zone. The Ravens are tied. And I didn't know who the Ravens were playing, and there was nothing I could care less about. But I was talking to my little sister, man, for the first time in 6.5 years. And I started, just kept sending those tickets, man, and we developed this little phone relationship around football. And I started driving at the end of the work week, and I had my second big job in AA. I was vacuuming swimming pools for $500 a week, man. I couldn't believe it. And I'm paying the IRS. I owed the IRS $43,000 and I'm paying them $20 a week, and I have no idea why I'm doing that, because you can't pay off $43,000 $20 a week, right? And I had a plan for paying the IRS. I told my sponsor what the plan was, right? I said, when I get $43,000, I'm going to pay them. And you guys had the same plan, huh? The problem is that we never have that, right? And you know when the fear and the sickness and the anxiety all went away? When I walked into the IRS office, turned myself in, my sponsor said, they're not going to lock you up. They don't like to lock up the goose that lays the golden egg. If they lock you up, they're not getting a cent. They're going to give you a payment plan, and darn if they didn't. And you know when I got free? When I sent the first check, I stopped thinking about it. And I'll tell you, it took 4.5 years for me to pay off that money. I went and put that last check in. My little sponsor with a pacemaker jumped up over the mailbox in the center of town, and we did this high five, and he said, say it to the mailbox, say it. And there's all these people around. I'm like, this is weird. And I said, my amends to the IRS is complete. And he said, yeah, buddy. And he hugged me, and I'm looking around. And about a year went by, and I got this big letter, and I opened it up, and inside was this big check, man. And I drove to his house, and I said, I screwed something up. They're after me again. They sent this check, and he looked at it, and he said, that's called a tax refund check, dummy. Normal people get those every year. So I've been getting those like every year, and it turns out that's pretty cool. You know, I got to pay them whether I agree or not. Does not matter. You know, I just got to do it, and then they send some money back. So we got a pretty good relationship now. That little sister, through that relationship, at the end of the work week, I would drive down to Baltimore. And then driving down there, I would help her paint the walls in this first little house that she bought. And I would help her fix the floor and fix this place up. And it was 3 hours each way. And I was always tired at the end of the work week. And it was never convenient. I never had enough money to do it. I never had enough energy. I'd come back Sunday night to go to work on Monday morning. And that relationship grew and grew and grew because I was acting like a brother, whether I wanted to or not. My other experience with our ninth step is that if you're waiting around for it to be convenient, you're going to be waiting a long time. It was never convenient. My sponsor says, if AA is convenient, you're doing it wrong. That's what it's all about, is being inconvenienced for somebody else, right? And that relationship grows and grows and grows, and I get this phone call one day, one of the best phone calls I've ever gotten in my life, and he says, my name's Justin, and I knew who it was. They've been dating for a while, and he said, I know your father's no longer with you, no longer a part of your life, but over the years, you've become the number one man in your little sister's life, and I'm calling to ask you if I might have her hand in marriage. I got to tell you, there is no worse big brother in the world, or no drunk less qualified to give away the hand of a beautiful little girl than me. And she called the next day and asked if I'd walk her down the aisle, and I got to do that, a sober man of integrity, like you fellas, with my head up and my shoulders back, and walk her down there, man. And it was an awesome day. And that relationship's just gotten better and better, and I'm so grateful that that happened, because she's got a little boy, Sadler, my first nephew, that's 2 years old, and she just had a second who's Brixton. He's 1 year old, and because of our relationship and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, our kids are going to get to grow up together. My little nine-month-old, Isabella, with Sadler and Brixton, they're going to be a part of each other, and my mother, and then we're all in the same room at the same place all the time now. And it's like the bright spot of my life. The next one was I had this friend named Ethan. He was my oldest friend in the world. We'd been friends since second or third grade. He asked me to be the best man in his wedding years back when I was out taking over the world one drug deal at a time in La Jolla. And his father sent me a plane ticket, had me fit it for a tuxedo, and purchased me the tuxedo so that I could be the best man in his wedding. And I was so excited to be the best man in his wedding that the night before I was to get on the plane, I started drinking. I, you know, I'm excited. And our book talks about that. I get tight at exactly the wrong time, and you guys know what happens once I start. Because this phenomenon of craving, what it looks like for me is when I take so much as one drink, that first drink asks for a second. Second begs for a third. Third demands the fourth. The fourth insists on the fifth, and I want the sixth drink more than I ever wanted that first one. And that never happens in the average or temperate drinker. So if you have any idea what I was just talking about, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to The Rock. As this progresses, I'm scared to talk to Ethan. I know what he's going to say to me. He's going to say, you're a no good bum, man. I invited you. You don't even show up to be the best man of my wedding. I knew. I heard his wife was beautiful. I heard he had a kid, another kid. Years had gone past. And I'm sober now. And there's people. The other thing that every alcoholic has is caller ID. And Ethan was on that secret list I used to have. You know that list. Some of you still got it. When you got to look at the phone number before you answer the phone. If you need to look at caller ID before you answer your phone, you are living in what's called bondage of self. I don't have time to talk it. Talk to your sponsor about that. It's something else. And I'll tell you, it's wonderful to be free of. If you call me, y'all know how I answer the phone. Hello, Rich Bruckner. Doesn't matter who's on the other end of the phone. Nobody's looking for me. No wants, no warrants. I don't owe anybody a penny. How free do you want to be? And on the other, you know, I knew what he was going to say. I knew exactly what he was going to say. And he told those kids what a scumbag I was. And he told his wife. And I called him. I said, listen, I'm on this thing called the Ninth Step in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I really screwed up at your wedding and I let you down and I'm a lousy friend. I need 5 minutes with you and your father. This is a life or death deal, man. I don't ever want to have to take another drink. Can I please try to straighten this out with you all? He said, yeah, you could be here Saturday at 8 a.m. if you can make it. It was almost 9 years later, he remembered. And I showed up. It's a three-hour drive. I had some money in my pocket, you know, to meet. I saw his parents' car in the driveway. I knocked on the door. He answered the door. His wife's standing by the kitchen island. There's a little girl by her feet. His mother and father are in the back. And what I didn't see was this little boy, man. This little boy came darting from somewhere. He ran at me like a freight train. He grabbed a hold of my leg, and he looked me square in the eyes. And he said, you're my Uncle Rich. Dad said one day I'd meet you. And right then and there, man, I had this inward knowing that I'm what separates me from you. I'm the one that keeps me separate from you. And the problem with that is that if I'm separate from you, I'm separate from God. He hadn't been telling those kids that stuff. Man, I've been putting that up there. And my stupid ego, my inability to admit I was wrong, my inability to say the words, I screwed up again, I'm sorry, I've messed up, how can I make this right? To just get that ego, all of that went away in a split second with that kid holding onto my leg. See, you all didn't sell me anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. You didn't convince me to believe in your God. You didn't sell me your God. You didn't teach me to pray your way. None of that. You said, please take our steps and have your own experience. See what happens. Try this spiritual experiment called the 12 steps and report back to us what happens. Bill says it in his story. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. That's been my significant. That is significant because that is what happened to me. I came here, I saw it happening. That's what happens when I come to the meetings. I come to the rock. I'm seeing it happening in your guys' lives. I started to feel it happening in my own, and eventually I believed it for myself. In that order. See, what we have in AA is a God of experience. We say, feel it for yourself and report back. I sat down with this father after I made the amends with Ethan. And I will tell you, with those kids, I go down there every Christmas after my family. I spend Christmas with those kids, take gifts there. Birthdays, I do the three-hour drive. When it snows, I drive 3 hours each way to take them sleigh riding. And you know what those little kids say? They say, Uncle Rich, you show up on all the good days like it's an accident. But AA lets me show up on all the good days. And when I sat down with his father, I made my amends to him, and I said, I think I owe you some money for the tuxedo and the plane ticket. Went through the whole AA deal, and he said, you're darn right, you owe me $1,372. And I didn't see that coming either, you know, but page 78 says, you know, 9 out of 10 times when the approach is made in this fashion, the unexpected happens. And I had it in my pocket, and I start to pull it out, and he said, hey, whoa. If you're really in this thing called AA, you really sponsor these guys, you're really an active part of the home group, what you're going to do is no more than $10 at a time, you're going to take donuts to your home group. You're going to buy them some special coffee every now and then. You're going to take some cookies. You're going to put gas in a newcomer's car so that he can get to the next meeting. Put the gas in his car. Don't give him the money, right? And save every receipt. None of them can be for more than $10. And when you have $1,372 worth of receipts, you bring them back to me here in Baltimore. And on that day, your amends to me will be complete. By the way, I'm sober 28 years in AA. I've been praying for the two of you since you've been that big. And I didn't see that coming. And I had one last amend, you know, and it was the one that we'd been saving for last because I owed a judge, and you know how judges are. He put me on this probation out in California, a thing called the PC 1000, First Time Offenders Program. Our California friends might know what it is. It's a felony diversion program where a judge takes a risk. It gives you some alcohol treatment, probation. If you go to, you know, 10 AA meetings and this and that and the other thing, it goes away. You don't have a felony. I mean, it would have been a non-conviction. But I had no idea when I told that judge what I tell every judge, you bet, Your Honor, I'll do whatever you say, that alcoholism owned me lock, stock, and barrel. It wasn't up to me whether I was going to complete that probation or not. Alcohol owned me. And when I screwed it up, I ran away, because that's what I do. So I owed him. The judge said to me, when I give you this deal, if I put you on this, I'm going to give you every day out of 5 years that this carries if you fail to complete this. Are we clear? And I said, yes, Your Honor, we are. And my sponsor said, I had about 2 years sober at this point. He said, this is a great time to go do that 5 years. I did not think so. Sponsors see things different. And he said, how free do you want to be, kid? This is a great time. I got on that plane, I flew out there, and I was scared to death, and a whole bunch of you all came with me to the airport and were cheering for me and had faith in me that I might not have had for myself, and I went in front of that judge, and what I did not know is that 47 of you took the time to write that judge letter to tell him about the last 2 years of my life and how many meetings I've been to and the guys I was sponsoring and the men's big book study in my living room every Wednesday night and the floors I was mopping in churches and pastors that we didn't even have AA meetings at were writing that judge letters, and I stood there, and he looked at me like I had three heads. And he said, what do you have to say for yourself? And I said, Your Honor, I flew 3,000 miles on my own nickel. I'm here to do that 5 years. I don't ever want to have to take another drink, and I apologize for not completing the probation. And he said, what? And I said, I'm here to serve the 5 years, Your Honor. And he said, well, these 47 letters tell me that you've done this, that. And he goes through them all. He said, I've never seen anything like this. And by these letters, they tell me that you've done far more than I ask you to do. Not the way that I told you to do it, but you've done it. And this case is dismissed. And he hit that hammer down. And I walked out of that courtroom. And if you pulled my NCIC, I've been arrested 36 times. And I've gone to jail 36 times. I'm a jail guy. I told you that. I don't ever get breaks. And on that day, my God got exponentially larger. And I stepped in the hallway and I said, Roger, 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 I'm coming home. I'm not doing the 5 years. Tell the guys they don't have to move the big book study. Tell them they don't have to find a new sponsor. I'm coming home. And he said, well, wait a second, hotshot. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You can't get a ticket until tomorrow, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, what about that Jesuit college that kicked you out? Aren't they right around the corner out there somewhere? Why don't you go straighten that out? And I'm thinking, like, can't we have a moment of celebration? But the ninth step talks about action and more action. I went over to that Jesuit school and I talked to the dean, and wouldn't you know it, all those years later, it was the same dean, because that's how AA works. A series of coincidences, right? And I sat down with the dean and I said, I don't know if you remember me. My name's Rich Bruckner. I used to go to college here. You all kicked me out, and I went off to... She said, Rich, stop. We know who you are. We've only had one student go to the federal penitentiary. And I said, well, listen, I'm in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got a thing called a ninth step, and I now understand what I did to this university. I know what the Jesuits are, and I brought a great deal of shame to this institution. You all stand for building men of integrity and education and doing the right thing, and I didn't stand for any of that when I went here. And I have no idea how to make this right, but I'll do whatever you tell me to make it right. And she said, come with me if you're sincere. And we went next door to a building I'd never been in. She put a huge stack of papers in front of me. She said, this is an application to our law school. What you're going to do is fill this out. You're going to go here. You're going to graduate. You're going to go on to make us proud. That's how you're going to make this right. Believe it or not, we don't like kicking people out. We like graduating students. It makes our numbers look good. What makes us look good is graduating students, not kicking them out. I step outside, I call my sponsor, I said, Roger, this lady's lost her mind, she wants me to go to law school, I don't have any brains left, I barely made it through college, and even if I go to law school and somehow pass that, they're never going to let me take the bar, I'm a federal felon, and even if I do that, they're never going to let me through the ethics committee, and even if I do that, they're never going to let me, blah, blah, blah. He said, shut up. Did you just tell that lady you'd do whatever she said to make it right? And I said, yes, sir. He said, then shut up and fill out the papers. And I did that. And I will tell you that 3 years later, I graduated second from the top of my class in that law school, not because I'm smart, but because I did it the AA way. I showed up 15 minutes early for every class in that law school, and I shook every teacher's hand every single day, just like we do with the newcomer, until they knew my name personally. I stayed 15 minutes after class, and I asked a question every day, whether I had one or not, just like we do with the newcomer after the meeting. And it turns out that that program of action, that habit, that skill, that spiritual discipline, whatever you want to call it, it has served me well in many, many areas of life. And I did have to go in front of that judicial committee, and I wish you guys were a fly on the wall, because it was funny. There's nine of them to determine whether I'm of moral fiber enough to practice law, which is funny in and of itself. And and they say, you know, we can't figure this out. You've got these wonderful grades and these wonderful letters of recommendation, but you've got these 36 arrests. We can't figure out for the life of us what's going on here. And I said, well, Your Honors, I had to disclose to you in the application process that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how familiar you are with Alcoholics Anonymous, but there is a substantial period of drinking required for membership. And they started laughing like you guys. And I think what God did was He gave me the right panel on the right day that they thought. And I said, you guys, if I take so much as one drink, I promise you I will be self-eliminating from the practice of law. You won't have to worry about me. Alcohol will worry about me. And I came through that committee, and it wasn't probably 3-4 weeks later, as soon as I come through that, had passed the bar, that my phone rings and some weird number, but thank God I can answer my phone now. And on the other end of the phone is some guy that says he's the state's attorney for the whole state of Maryland. He's got the governor on a conference call. He's been given a large federal grant. He says, well, I just got this grant. I want to hire an assistant state's attorney to head up our narcotics and gang prosecution division. I've been given your phone number that you might know something about the importation of narcotics into our country. Would you like to serve our state as the narcotics chief? And my knees are about buckling. But you know what I thought? The very first thing I thought of was those old guys, man, with that book in their hand and that smile on their face. And you know what they promised me? They said, kid, one day your sordid past will become your greatest asset. And I can tell you that each morning that it wasn't easy at first, because you know how judges are. They try to trick you and stuff. They would say things like, would the defendant please rise? And I'd stand up, and they'd say, no, no, no. You know, and it was embarrassing, but I was just used to being the defendant. But I got the hang of it after a while. I got the hang of it. And now what I know that God did is when I stand at that prosecution table and I look across at that defense table where I used to stand, a lot of people might see an armed robber of a liquor store at 4 a.m. when a guy breaks in, has a gun, whatever he's doing. You know what he steals? He steals one pint of liquor. And you know what I see? A guy when the morning terror and madness were on would steal from his mother's slender purse just like I did. And I can tell you that I've come up with some very creative sentencing arrangements over the last 6 years. And I've gotten to serve the state of Maryland in that capacity for the last 6 years. The result of practicing law, the way that I live life in Alcoholics Anonymous, my name was just sent up as one of three to our new governor by the Judicial Nominating Committee to be, if I'm chosen, which I have no idea what God wants me to do next, it would make me the youngest circuit court judge in the state of Maryland. We'll see who gets selected. I don't know. And that's nothing I did. Nothing I did. All I do is I practice law with the same integrity that you all teach me in your meetings. You teach me that at places just like this, hanging out with guys like you. You taught me that, how to do it at meetings. You taught me that with a newcomer. You taught me that in school, and I take that into the workplace. And you've taken a very segregated life of separation and brought it together where I have just one life today. There's nothing called my family life, my work life, my AA life. It's just one life. And I can't thank you enough for it. Every day I get to say two amazing things. Every morning I get to go into that courtroom, and with a tremendous amount of gratitude and respect, I say, good morning, Your Honor, Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. And every night I get to say something far more important when I come to be with guys like you. I get to say that my name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for my life. That's all I got.